Thank you, sir. Let me remind you, please, when we're done here, the books will be available for a little bit. First one's 20, after that it's 15. Get some for your network, get some for your fathers, get some for the fathers in your life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's do, go ahead, yes, sir.
Let me just, sure. Hey, also, before you throw your box away, the gentleman who made this all possible and helped, there's actually two of them here, but also, Glenn Murdoch has given you a coupon that you can stop by his franchise over there, but specifically, Jim Peavy with Grant Construction and Tony Lombardi from the Lombardi Group helped fund this, so let's give those guys a big hand. And now, is anybody going to confront me with my talking with my mouth full? No? Okay.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Okay, let's do a few questions, and then we're going to have some final things that Buzz is going to do. And so, fire away. Let me help you as much as I can in the next 20 minutes or so.
Hey, Steve. Jason here. Can you tell us a little bit more about your book? You know, you probably talk about your four maxims, but if I were to give it to my neighbor, like what can I expect to tell him about the book?
Great question.
My book, Mansfield's Book of Manly Men, is a kind of a humorous, hard-hitting, coaching kind of book on manhood. It starts with the four maxims, a bigger development of the four maxims, and then it goes into vignettes, stories of men in the Bible and through history who illustrate some of the principles of great manhood. And what I did was I used stories from famous men that most people don't know. I sort of told the reverse side, like when I'm talking about a man's need for it to have some wildness in his life or to have nature in his life. Theodore Roosevelt, everybody knows Theodore Roosevelt, great man, president, but most people don't know that Theodore Roosevelt, his wife and his mother died on the same day in the same house. And he almost killed himself in response. But rather than do that, he went out into the wild, got in nature, it healed him, and he became the great man later. So I tell the dark side. Everybody knows Lincoln's a great guy. But Lincoln suffered such black dog depressions that he almost committed suicide two or three times. So my point's not to do some kind of, you know, negative view of everybody in history, but I want to show what men had to overcome. Many of you who are into manhood and manly values will know about the Kipling poem, If, you know, which is the all-time man poem. It's in my book. But Kipling was beaten up all the time for being the little bespectacled guy and not athletic and all that. So I tell that story, and then I say, but he had a manly vision, so he could pour that into literature. So there are all sorts of vignettes at the back, things that people you will know, people you won't know. The only guy who went into Auschwitz voluntarily so he could work with the Allies, all that kind of stuff. And all of these things illustrate manly principles. The thing that will be helpful to you is at the end of every chapter, because of course I intended this book to be processed by men in groups and as a band of brothers, there are six or seven action points. You know, the whole idea of show yourself a man. I didn't want to just describe stuff and then not give men things to do. So the practical things to discuss, practical things for you to do at the end of each chapter. So it's an action plan. It's meant to be processed with men, hold each other accountable, work it through, and so on. So that's the book. That's the book. All right?
First, I've got a question for Buzz. You may have said this, but I've got a manly question. Do we get seconds?
There are seconds. So, right. And for some of you guys, I've seen seconds already. There's thirds, so just get up there.
And I've got
no
a question
condemnation,
over here.
There's no shame. Go grab the food.
Yes, Stephen, my name is Rick, and I have a question. It's on your other book here. I'm assuming like most Americans and Christians, we've had to witness and something we never thought we would have to witness is Daesh or ISIS and their treatment of Christians, their treatment of Muslims that they disagree with, and we've had to witness Americans losing their lives in brutal manner. And I'm wondering, I guess my question is, you having some experience in Iraq with the various ethnic groups there, what is your take on it? Did you ever think that you would see a nation that would stand by and let it happen, which is somewhat of what we're doing, and your solution to the problem?
It's a good question. I'll do it in a few seconds, and then you can ask more. I'm stunned at how the Western world is sitting by and letting Christians be murdered in the Middle East. Absolutely stunned by it. Didn't think I'd see it. Didn't think it could happen. We all know that if there were other people groups, ethnicity, sexual persuasions that were being murdered in mass, there would be a much faster response. What's going on in Iraq is that Iraq was basically put together with spit and baling wire after World War I. It was an artificial country. It was really only held together by kings, by monarchs who were fairly dictatorial, or by dictators like Saddam Hussein. Shiite, Sunni, and Kurds were all kind of super glued together in the same unit that's never really been workable. So now, and Baghdad is notoriously corrupt, Sunnis and Shiites are having tension. The only thing that's workable in Iraq are the Kurds. The Kurds are the descendants of the ancient Medes. When you read your Bibles and you see the laws of the Medes and the Persians, the Kurds are the descendants of the Medes. And so they, because of what they've suffered, and also because of what we see in biblical history, that they a lot of them are Jews and things of that nature, they have a very moderate form of Islam. They're very pro-Western, and they're pro-Israel. So here you have a Muslim people, 97% Muslim, but when I go to Kurdistan, as I will Monday and have done many times before, there's a Christian department in the KRG, in the Kurdish regional government. There are women on the Supreme Court. I sat with a senior mullah in the country, and he said, I'm not going to let this radicalism in here. I'm a Kurd first and a Muslim second. Well, that'll get you killed in Saudi Arabia. But the senior mullah in Kurdistan, in fact, I had a little joke with him. He was going on like this real stridently about how he was a Kurd first and a Muslim second. And I finally said, you know, I have felt pretty safe in this country until now. And now you, the mullah, are going to get me, the Christian, killed with what you're saying. You know, so it became a big kind of a joke, because normally in the Middle East, you're afraid of the mullah, right? This mullah is talking so radically, he's going to get me in trouble. And so I think the big solution for us now as a nation is one that I'm advocating for, and there's some movement in Congress about. And that is, we've got to directly arm the Kurds. The Kurds are the main boots on the ground against ISIS. And they are being successful, just as it is, with air support, with Western air support. But what happened was, we had given a huge amount of weapons to the Iraqi army. And in their first encounter with ISIS, they left all those expensive weapons in the field. ISIS took them. And so then the Kurds, who are fantastic fighters, guerrilla fighters, they're Peshmerga troops. Peshmerga means those who face death. Began to have to fight the ISIS troops, who were using American mechanized and high-tech weapons. So in the meantime, our laws don't allow us at this point to directly arm the Kurds. So here you got this fight against ISIS. They got our weapons. But the Kurds are fighting them, and fighting them valiantly. They won most of the battles, driven them off of the dams, taken back Kobani, places like that, but our laws don't let us directly arm the Kurds. Our laws require that we go through Baghdad, which is corrupt and where they don't like the Kurds, so they take everything that's meant to go to the Kurds. So now there's finally an initiative on the floor of the House that should allow for the direct arming of the Kurds. And if we do that, I think the Kurds will probably be able to defeat ISIS in Iraq. And then it will spread from there. So quite frankly, this is not some big force that has arisen that is just going to dominate the Middle East. This is a force that's relatively easy to defeat. The problem is that our own allies in the region have supported ISIS. The Saudis were supporting them with huge money until recently, and the only way they get into the Middle East is to come through Turkey, which is supposed to be our other big ally in the Middle East. They come straight through Istanbul and come down across the border. So we choose our friends badly in the Middle East, and we betray those who are genuinely our friends. Bottom line is, we got to pass this law. We've got to get some courage and back the Kurds. and they will defeat ISIS. The Peshmerga are about 200,000, well, anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000. Daesh is, the ISIS is about 40,000 people. Problem is we haven't seriously begun to fight. It's typical of Western kind of style right now in the Middle East. We could easily win, we just don't really show up for the fight. And so actually countries like Germany and Britain are doing far more than America is. And it's actually a shame. And I don't mean to play politics, I'm gonna say something a little controversial. This administration's not real good at Middle East stuff, and I don't mean that as a political statement, I just mean it as a policy statement. And so what Barack Obama did when ISIS first hit is he turned to all the factions in Iraq and he said, you guys get in a room and create a coalition government and then we'll begin to arm you. Then we'll begin to supply you. Well, you know, some of the conflicts between Sunni and Shiites go back 1,200 years, you know. There are terrorists at the door. Could you arm us first and we'll work this stuff out later? I mean, that was kind of, so instead, months and months and months went by while ISIS was chopping off heads and the U.S. did not provision anybody. Not even the government in Baghdad. So it's a pretty bad situation. There are places where Christianity was vibrant. It doesn't exist anymore in Iraq in certain places. Mosul is ancient Nineveh. It was a Christian stronghold. There are no Christians in Mosul anymore. There are no Christians there. And now they're heading towards Palmyra in Syria, which is a historic Christian stronghold. I've driven through the desert and seen it. It's about to be destroyed by ISIS, because when they go through, they destroy all the archaeological sites. So it's a bad situation, but like the state of manhood, we can easily turn it around. We just have to decide to show up for the fight. So yeah, I'm stunned by the death of Christians. That's one of the reasons I go over there, is to be a spokesman for all that kind of stuff and an advocate for the Kurds, why I wrote the book I wrote. And I mean, we can turn it around, but we're going to have to get serious about it, and we've done a lot of dithering.
So let's pray and read the book and contact our congressman. We got a question here. And this is Dominic. Everybody say hi.
Hello, everybody. My question is, in your, as a recommendation for all of us and for how you've been able to apply it to your own inner core group, your band of brothers, how do you see social media in the relationship you have with those men closest to you, and what kind of boundaries do you set up that might be encouragement for us on what we might do?
That's a great question. We're grateful for social media. We use it, obviously. We text, we write, but we do have some boundaries. One is no of the tougher business will be done in a man's life via social media. So in other words, you don't write a man a text and say, you chew like a fool or whatever. You know, you don't hurt a man by doing that kind of thing. Our rule is that anything that has to be addressed should be addressed live. Now, it could be a live conference call we all jump on. It can be a Skype chat with a brother. It can be, you know, sitting in his living room. But you don't send an email. You don't write a text. You don't, you know, post a video on Facebook and say, I know there's a million people watching this, but I really want to speak to Joe. You know, Joe, clean it up. I mean, that's not how we work. So that's our rule. You can't speak to anything in a person's life other than live and confidential. But we use the text to talk smack and schedule things and encourage each other and all that kind of stuff. I would recommend a rule like that if you're going to do that. Otherwise, we get real lazy and, hey, I meant to talk to you about so-and-so the other day, but I forgot. But really, you need to be nicer to your wife. Bye, game's on. You know, and like, that's going to become fighting words more than, you know, real help. Good question. You guys choose who speaks, and I'll just respond. Yes, sir.
You would probably stand out like a sore thumb over in Iraq, even
I do.
Northern Iraq. How do you do that safely? How do you get there?
How do I get there? I fly Delta to Istanbul. And once I get to Istanbul, I take Turkish Air into Erbil. So I'll leave here tomorrow. Thank God you guys have got a flight from here, from San Diego to Detroit. Not tomorrow, sorry, Monday. I'll fly from Detroit to Amsterdam. I'll smoke some weed. I'll get back on the plane. I don't know why I said that. I don't smoke weed.
Don't send me an email.
just happens to be legal there. I'm just messing around. And I'll fly from Amsterdam to Istanbul. and then I'll lay over 2 or 3 hours and I'll fly on into Erbil. The government's invited me to come and they assign bodyguards to me. It's not that I'm any big thing, but I'm an advocate for them, and so they, you know, I'm not an ambassador or anything, but they value me as a friend and they make sure I'm protected. I stay in a better hotel they help me with, and they often laugh. I'll even turn to the bodyguards through an interpreter and say, "Now, what exactly is going to happen here if somebody starts shooting and I'm like 2 feet taller than you?" And they often joke and say, "Well, we'll duck." You know, they're a lot of fun. But it's in Erbil now, in the Kurdish parts. It's as dangerous as being in Jerusalem. Everybody goes to Jerusalem. You can have a great time. You go home. You hardly ever feel anything. But the Starbucks could blow up, and it has. The bus could blow up, and it has. That's the way it is. But it's not any worse than that. You go south now. ISIS is 500 miles south, on the run, by the way. Sure, something can happen. And they had a car bomb in Erbil not too long ago, but they had a car bomb in Jerusalem not too long ago, too. So the best way I can express it, since maybe you guys are more familiar with Jerusalem, maybe you take trips to the Middle East, is that it's about like Jerusalem. And, I'm careful. You know, we don't tell everybody things. We misdirect. I don't mind letting you know that we misdirect in our social media a little bit. We don't just out and out lie, but, you know, I'll be over there. There'll be a picture of me standing here with you, you know. You know what I mean? So that people who are watching don't know where we are. Mm-hmm. And everything I've told you may not be true. No, I'm just playing. But we're careful. We've been doing this for a lot of years. I don't plan to shake off this khaki coil, you know, in the deserts of Iraq. Trust me. I want to die a man in bed at old age, you know. So I appreciate your expressing the concern. Yeah. And I just think it's essential that we go. Just essential that we do it. I really do. And I love the Kurds. I think the Kurds are amazing, amazing people. They really changed my life, and I'm happy to advocate for them.
Here's a question over here.
Stephen, I'm confused about the timeline of some of the things. You started telling us a story last night about how you were in Syria, and the guys were shooting on the roof, and they called you Abu John.
Yeah.
And that kind of revealed to you that there was something missing from your life.
Yeah.
Like you had never been called into manhood. But then... also, you have the band of brothers. So, like, how did all this come together? What was the sequence of events and kind of led you to the understanding which caused you to write the book?
Yeah, the real turning point was in the late 90s when I was in Syria. This is when we were, I pastored a large church in Nashville, and we formed an NGO to help the Kurds when the Kurds started pouring into Nashville after the Gulf War. And I was not the leader of it. I was just helping out. I was a senior pastor of this big old church. And that's the season during which I got stuck in Syria. Okay, so I have to go back and look at the passport or whatever. I think it was like 99, 98, somewhere in there. Okay, so then I start doing my own work on manhood, and you know, I get on the phone with Eldridge, who's helped me a lot, and you know, I began to study the things I've kind of shown you up here, finding these scriptures, reading books, trying to figure it out. And then what happens is I transition out of the pastorate in 2002 and immediately begin to write some books that do really well. I was very fortunate. I was the kind of guy who knew I wouldn't pastor forever, that eventually I transition out, more directly engage culture and do some of the things I'm made to do. So in 2003, I wrote the book, The Faith of George W. Bush, and it just blew up, repositioned my life financially, and repositioned me in terms of my platform. So at that point, I'm down the road, I'm working on this whole manhood thing, I'm continuing to watch, pay attention to what's going on with men, and I begin to realize if God continues to give me a platform where I can write books and they'll be read by people just because I wrote them, and then we can grow from there, I'd like to write a book on manhood. And years later, that's what happened. So, as you guys reminded me last night, I had forgotten what the release date was. 2013, this book came out. I obviously wrote it the year before, so that's 2012. And so, you know, for about a decade, I was writing other kinds of books, Faith of George W. Bush, Faith of Barack Obama. I wrote a book called The Search for God in Guinness that's about the Guinness Beer Company. It's Christian moorings, and it's doing good in society and so on. All the while, the man stuff is percolating in my soul, and I'm teaching it at kind of a devotional level in my church or when I'm asked to out other places. I just haven't gotten formal with it yet. I don't have the big keynote presentation. I don't have a book. I don't have a wristband. I haven't made a wristband yet, you know. So... But then when the book came out, wasn't the trumpet call to this movement, to this big manly movement, but it resonated with everybody who was already there. So it started to bring together a lot of people who were doing awesome stuff just because there was nothing else anybody else was doing that was significant. Promise Keepers wasn't active during this season, and so that connected me up to all of them because they read the book and said, this guy's singing our song. That's the whole story. Oh, that came about when I got to D.C. When I started living in D.C., my band of brothers probably formed for the first time. Just give me, let me do the thing. 2007, 2008. So I've got a band of brothers for 3 or 4 years before this book is written. And I thought about incorporating them into the book, in a sense. And then I thought, no, let's not make it about me and my band of brothers, you know, because these guys are an unusual crowd. I'm the white spot on this large African-American church, and a lot of the Redskins go there. So a couple of my guys are former Redskins, which is not exactly a brag these days, given how the Redskins are doing. And then some other guys are like ex-military and just guys. And so that's when all that comes together. So, you know, by the time I write this book in 2012, I guess I've been walking with some form of band of brothers for 3 or 4 years.
So we got a question over here in the back.
Stephen, what's the first step? And let's say I'm a new member of this church, and I don't know too many people, and I want to do this, but how do I do it? What's the process, and what's the first step?
Well, I don't know if you're here Thursday. Were you here Thursday night when I was talking about Jonathan and David?
I'm sorry?
Were you here Thursday night when I was talking about Jonathan and David?
Yeah.
Okay, good. In my view, it's, first of all, decide where you want to go. Who are you? What do you want to do? I want to have a band of brothers. I want to perfect righteous manhood. And start looking, I mean literally looking, not talking, but looking for men who seem to have that same passion, who seem to want that. Meet them in church, you know, keep an eye on them, listen to them testify, come here and watch what they say, you know, chat at lunch, whatever. But the reason I'm saying that is remember that in the Jonathan and David story, Jonathan became one in spirit with David and loved him as himself. So often it's that you identify with a guy. You know, you kind of go, I like that guy. I wonder if he'd be willing to pull in with me on this. And then we've all got to have, if we're going to build a band of brothers, we've got to have the skills of just engaging in normal lunchtime conversation and then just moving it to a little bit of wider bandwidth to include manhood. You know, so you don't send a guy you've never met a card and say, would you be in my band of brothers? You know, that's not how that works. What you do is you just start, as I said earlier, bringing it up with a guy and saying, you know, this whole thing about manhood. Like, let's say there's a guy in here you're thinking, I'd like to see if he wants to pull in with me. You know, so you'd go to lunch with the guy or you'd talk to him, you say, what do you think about what Mansfield said? Do you make it any sense to you? You know, how do you feel about that? You know, and you've ever had a band of brothers? You know, you're just kind of warming up to the subject. And then eventually you can say, well, man, I'm sure open to speak it into your life. You want to speak into mine? Or maybe you don't do that on the first lunch, you know, then you say, well, why don't we go play golf next week? Why don't we go for a run? And you just bring things up while you're doing other things, while you're building friendship. Remember that the key to this thing is not an artificial structure where we're sitting around talking about manhood with a bunch of men we're not friends with. The issue is we're doing life together, and the manhood thing is woven all through it. So one thing I don't want is a bunch of guys who are only meeting to talk about certain principles out of my book or something like that. That's thin. Build a friendship. Build a friendship the way you build friendship with other people, and then add the additional bandwidth of these topics, you know? That's hey, good. Can I ask you a question? I've got a thing going with my son, and he's a nitwit. He's driving me crazy. Let me get some advice from a guy who's had sons, or just tell me what you see. Or, by the way, if you see anything in me that may be making me less effective with my son, tell me. You know, you start opening up that stuff, and you'll see whether a guy steps into it or not. You'll see whether he gravitates to it. If he kind of goes, ooh, no. You know, he starts pulling back, paying the bill, getting out of there, or faking cell phone calls, you know? I know you guys do that. You make your phone ring under the table, and then you go, okay, I'll be right there, and you get out of Dodge, you know. And so it's a natural process. It's as natural as making friends. Then you just bring this other thing to the table and see what comes of it. It's always a risk.
That's good. We got a question over here, too.
This kind of dovetails on that question. Ted and I are neighbors, and we've talked over the fence for 10 years, and this is the first thing we've gone together, you know, in the church. So we've kind of agreed. We said, hey, let's meet. Do you start with scripture, or do you start with your book, or do you just say, hey, let's go play golf? I don't even know if he plays. I mean, I'm just trying to get a, you know, foundational approach here, scripturally, probably.
Yeah, I mean, there is no pattern. I want to make that clear, not because I want to leave you flapping in the breeze, but because I don't want you to feel like you got to measure up to something. There's no pattern. Your main goal is to know each other and bring from your well of spiritual life and your well of manly knowledge and reading and biblical framework to each other's life what urges you towards righteous manhood. So normally we start at the vision level. The thing that I find usually works with men is talk about their fathers. What's been your masculine programming? If you don't want to use that phrase because it sounds a little funky, you know, masculine programming. What's your father like, man? How are you set up for manhood? I didn't have a father. I learned my stuff in the Army. I had to learn all of it. You know, that kind of thing. That gets you talking, right? You don't have to go straight to issues. You don't have to go straight to wounds. You know, you don't have to rush this thing. Get to know each other and find out what both of you are. What your background's been, what's been your framing as men, and what are you shooting for? You know, I gotta tell you, I wasn't a very good man with my son. I'm just making this up, by the way. It's not like I know either one of you. So it's not, guys are gonna go, well, man, he really knows them, and he's gonna say something really bad. Let's say that you weren't that great a father or weren't that great a man back when your sons were being raised. Now you got grandkids, and so you say to Ken, man, I really want to learn. I want to pass this down through the generations in a way that I can't through my sons because I blew it. You know, I was drinking heavily, or I had affairs, or I messed it up, or I wasn't present. So I really want to be intentional about this. You know, if you've got anything you can teach me or help me here, show me. Because my father didn't teach me. You know, and you just start. You know, it's funny. I'm not in any way going at your question, but it's funny if we'd seen a good movie, or we'd for some of us found a new kind of shampoo. Oh, we found an awesome awesome protein bar. I guess that's what we were having back. We would just rush into telling the guy about it, right? And so, but when it's something like this, we get a little hesitant because it's relational. So short answer to your question, ask the questions that learn, ask the vision questions. What do you want to, I mean, what? How would you move? What would the next level of manhood look like for you? What would that be if you were really growing to what you envision? You know, what's holding you back? And how can I help you kind of stuff? And then just keep it going from there. And ask the Lord all the way along to help you. And as you're reading books like mine, Eldridge, other things like that, you know, you bring up new topics. Maybe because I do so much reading and writing and research and book stuff, and maybe some of my guys are jocks, we will read books separately. We do not sit in a room and read books together. We don't read a book on a plan. We read books when the biggest guy threatens us, is kind of how that works, you know.